From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. It's been 3 months since a new chairman was appointed to Baltimore City's Liquor License Board. Has the regulation of bars and liquor stores tightened up? We hear from the new chairman, retired Judge Thomas Ward, and talk about it with writers for the Baltimore Brew and the blog Booze News. Then, the town of Crofton in Anne Arundel County is celebrating its 50th anniversary this month. What are the origins of this planned community? We ask author and Crofton historian Joseph Brown. And Tom Hall and Jay Wynn Russick discuss the Hippodrome's production of I Love Lucy live on stage. Plus, those Old Bay chips aren't just for snacking. Chef Sasha Wallhandler tells us how to spice up crab dishes in honor of Old Bay's 125th anniversary. First news.
I'm producer Jamila Kay. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock. That's on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming at WIPR.org. Now, on with the show.
Thanks, Nathan. This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. And first things, hey, you did it. Loyal listeners, sustaining members came through for WIPR in the fund drive that wrapped up last night. We who work here are so grateful, and we promise to make the very best use of every dollar you pledged. Thank you so much. Now to the news. It's been 3 months since leadership in Baltimore City's Liquor License Board was overhauled. Former City Circuit Court Judge Thomas Ward was appointed as chairman of the board, which is a state agency funded in the city budget. Governor O'Malley appointed Dana P. Moore to be one of the three commissioners and appointed Judge Ward to be commissioner and chairman of the board. The third commissioner, Harvey Jones, stayed in place. The board has had a bad reputation for some time now. In 2013, the state's Office of Legislative Audits came down hard on the board for problems with inspections, policies, and management. I spoke with Chairman Thomas Ward yesterday. He said before he was appointed, he was, quote, out of touch with what was happening at the board.
And apparently what was happening is that the liquor board forgot all about the community. And licenses are a privilege, not a right. And when you issue a liquor license, your conduct of how you operate the license should in no way detract from the life of a nearby neighbor. Unfortunately, we found that that was not true. Anyway, some of the exhibitions of evidence that we saw were absolutely stunning with respect to the harm that it caused the life that you might have if you live near one of these bars. And I think one of our jobs is to correct that.
3 months after the new board has been assembled, we want to find out what has been corrected. So joining us now is Fern Shen, editor of the online news site Baltimore Brew. Busy morning, Fern. I heard you on Inside Maryland Politics. Thanks.
Yes.
Thanks for coming in.
A hot topic. Thanks.
And also with us is Becky Witt, attorney with the Community Law Center. She blogs about the liquor board at their blog, Booze News. Welcome back.
Thank you very much.
Becky, we spoke in March about legislation the General Assembly was considering that aimed to make the liquor board more transparent. Has transparency been improved?
I think so. They've been making some good changes with things like making sure applications are complete, actually sending out inspectors to do more inspections. So I think that there have been some good changes since the audit came out, certainly, and since this new board was put in place. There are still a lot of issues, I think, with consistency from one hearing to the next. So the violation hearing, sometimes they'll give a 30-day suspension for a violation, and then the next week they'll give a 3-day suspension for the same violation. But so there's some consistency issues, but overall I think transparency has improved.
Yeah, the Baltimore Sun says that the revamped board is tougher, was the adjective in the headline. The Sun reported the board has found 119 bars and liquor stores guilty of violations in the last 3 months compared to 33 in the same period last year. And the Sun editorialized that Chairman Thomas Ward's leadership of the board called him a new sheriff in town. Fern, do you see this dramatic a shift?
I think somehow that narrative has hardened prematurely, in my opinion. The good news is they seem to be moving in the right direction. The good news is there's a very sort of robust community interest in pushing the board to be more responsive. But I think that they, the consistency issues that Becky's talking about are still there. You know, we just have a story in the Baltimore Brew noting that, you know, on the one hand, we had a recent zombie license. I can explain what a zombie license is for the listeners, but killed. And then, you know, not that long ago, a zombie license was allowed to walk among us by this board. This is not, you know, the historic, you know, previous board.
Becky, tell us what a zombie license is.
Sure. So a zombie license, basically, the legislature has decided and the city has decided that there are too many liquor licenses in Baltimore City. And so they're trying to not issue as many, and they're trying to let some expire that are not being used. And so the law says that if you haven't used your liquor license in the past 180 days, then your license expires on the 181st day, and it is no more. You can come in and ask for an extension of an additional 180 days for a total of 360 days. And historically, with the previous board and still with this board, they have given additional extensions out beyond that one hardship extension that the law provides. And it's just something that the law does not really allow for, but the board has been doing anyway. So zombie licenses are licenses that really are dead according to the law, but the board is allowing them to live on as if they were alive.
That's Becky Witt here on Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Also with us is Fern Shen of the Baltimore Brew. Becky is with the, I'm sorry, I'm missing the name of your group.
The Community Law Center.
Community Law yes. Center. The name of your blog is more memorable. Booze News is yes. Very hard to forget. We spoke with Chairman Ward yesterday, and he told us that, yes, in the past, the 180-day rule had been ignored. He says the 180-day law is complicated and out of date, and he's proposing there be some changes to the law.
I'm recommending changes with respect to liquor licenses that are delayed by government, where government itself doesn't act, give the permits or the things that are, and government is the cause of the delay, keeping the license from opening for business. You see, the law allows only a certain period of time, a maximum of 1 year, and the government operations today are much more complicated than they were a year, 10 years ago, or 15, 20 years ago, and they take a long time. We hear that all the time. Judge, we've applied before the zoning board, and they haven't given us an opinion, and we can't move until we get a solution, they say. So meanwhile, they sit. And then, of course, after a while, they then go for their construction permits, and government again delays them.
So I asked him if he was basically saying that it's often not the licensee's fault that a license lies unused for more than two 180-day periods. And he basically said yes. How does this strike you as, let me ask you, Becky, as someone who follows the board's action? I mean, is this a backdoor way to more delays, or do you think he is going to speed things up?
Well, I think that might be the case in about maybe half of the zombie license cases where the licensees really are trying to move things along and issues come up. But a lot of these licensees just close and for no really good reason except that maybe business isn't so good and it has nothing to do with waiting for permission from any city agency. And I think certainly as the chairman of the board, he should suggest changes to the law that would benefit communities and licensees, but I think the board needs to apply the law as it's written now until the law is changed.
Yeah, if I can just amplify that, I think that applying the letter of the law really helps to level the playing field for communities who are at such a disadvantage. I've seen them come up against, you know, some of the biggest law firms in town, and they're trying to, you know, plead their case, you know, as best they can. And, you know, having the board essentially, you know, really just sort of follow the law and follow it closely and try to do it equally is really, you know, maybe the only chance they're going to have to have an equal shot.
Ward told us about some of his plans for the liquor board for owners who have passed management on to other parties and operators. He wants to require that those owners appear with their licenses for any liquor board proceeding. And he said some owners have skipped the proceedings. He also says he has plans for bars that have become a public nuisance.
Well, my approach to it is to modify the punishment to close them for a short period of time to wake them up and tell them that if they come back again and they have this problem, then it's going to be much more serious. Now, the bars, of course, do not like to be closed. In the old days, they just got fined. And finding a bar that has a business like that doesn't make any difference to them. But closing it for a month, 2 months, a weekend, two weeks, and so forth, that makes a big difference to them. And so we're getting their attention all over. That's what I'm finding. We're getting the attention of the liquor industry.
Becky, we're almost out of time. What do you think of that approach? Does it fit into consistency?
Sure, yeah, I think it does. So I think that's great. I think I agree with him that suspensions really do get the attention of the licensee much more than a small fine. But yeah, the suspensions need to be consistent over time.
Fern, a last thought about his approach?
I agree. They seem to be kind of winging it a lot. If they can stay consistent with that, I think that approach could work.
Well, I know both of you are going to be keeping a close eye on this, and so we will keep in touch with you about it. I appreciate your coming in to talk about it.
Thank you.
On such a rainy morning. Fern Shen is editor of the online news site Baltimore Brew. Becky Witt is an attorney with the Community Law Center. She blogs about the liquor board at their blog, Booze News. More information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cash. Just ahead, the story of how Crofton came to be. Stay with us on 88.1.
Producer Jamila Kay. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Thanks for listening.
It's Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. If I ask you, what was the first planned community in Maryland? More than likely, the first place that comes to your mind is Columbia. Residents began moving into Columbia's 10 villages in 1967. But there's a planned community that predates Columbia. People began calling Crofton home in 1964. The Anne Arundel town is equidistant from Baltimore and D.C., 24 miles in each direction, and even closer, 15 miles, to Annapolis and Fort Meade. Crofton is celebrating its 50th anniversary this month. With us to talk about its origins is Joseph Brown, author of From Sotweed to Suburbia, A History of Crofton, Maryland Area, 1660s to 1960s. Joseph Brown, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
This word sotweed in the title of your book, what is sotweed and what does it have to do with Crofton's history?
Sotweed is tobacco,
uh-huh.
An early word for tobacco. And
a pejorative word or just?
I'm not sure its origin. King James I called it, actually, I had another name for it, called it this stinking weed. It was a commonly used word that people had.
Everybody back then would have known. They wouldn't have asked you that.
Oh, yes, yeah. And it was the only, practically the only way to earn a living in the 1600s, 1700s, 1800s. That was the culture for a couple of centuries, was tobacco. Based on tobacco.
Your investigation into Crofton's history starts with a place called Linthicum Walks.
Yes.
Briefly tell us about its significance.
Linthicum Walks is really the only house has survived in the Crofton area that dates back 200 years. And is a fairly typical house for Tidewater, Maryland. But because it's the only one left in the area, it's become a lot more significant because it's the only thing place people can see. But
is it a grand house or a farmhouse?
No, I don't. I never call these houses or these farms plantation houses or plantations. They're relatively small, 200 acres, 400 acres maybe.
And it was Linthicum Walks that pulled you into Crofton's history.
Right, right. When I moved to Crofton, I was like a lot of other people. I was from someplace else. There's all these new houses, and I was trying to figure out, well, what was here before all these new houses were here. And then I found out that the Board of Education had bought the land, the old farm, and they had plans for building a school right where the house was.
And this was about when?
1979. And so I got together with some other people and said, we have to stop that. There's a lot of room over there for schools. They don't have to build the school right where the house is. So we were able to convince the Board of Education that it was an important place. To do that, we had to redo research about the history of the Linthicum family, the house. And as we were doing that, I realized there was a whole community here of families, some other Linthicums, other families that began to get involved in the surrounding properties. I realized that we were really researching a community that had existed, an agricultural community that had existed there. After a while, I began writing articles for the local newspaper, the Crofton Town Crier. And then somebody said, well, why don't you write a book? I said, oh, no, I can't do that.
But you did.
I did. Yes.
On WIPR, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass, speaking with Joseph Brown, author of From Sotweed to Suburbia, A History of Crofton, Maryland Area, 1660s to 1960s. Let's jump to the 20th century, mm-hmm. the 1960s. Yes. How did who created what we now know as Crofton, and what was the vision?
W. Hamilton Crawford from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, was the creator, the developer, the brains, the money behind it. And so the vision was to plan the whole community in every detail before a single house was built. Plan the streets, plan the school sites, plan the commercial areas, try to plan some areas for where people could be employed, often an office park, business park, and lay out the community in a way that heavy traffic would be deflected to main roads. He knew he could buy 1,300 acres of land, and so he could actually lay out a whole community. 1,300 acres sounds like a lot, but compared to Columbia, Maryland, it was a lot less than they started with.
How successful was his development?
Very. It was very popular. He had no problem selling houses.
What did they sell for back then?
Oh, goodness. $20,000, something like that, yeah.
So who was he aiming for?
Oh, a middle class. He intended it to be a middle class community. It was built around a golf course, an 18-hole golf course, parts of which would project into the community. So you had a lot of green space in the community. It was intended for a middle class, and it was intended to be, I would say, exclusive. And this is where he's often criticized, because one of the requirements was you had to join the country club to own a house there. Hmm. And that added an expense, of mm-hmm. course. For a while there was a gate, so it was a gated community for a while. And it was, as long as he was involved in it, it was a gated community. He's been accused of not being open to sales to blacks and other minorities.
And what changed that?
In 1966, 65, he ran out of money. I think what really happened was that he ran out of credit. His creditors were saying, things have changed. We need some of that money back soon. And he didn't have it because he had put so much into the land and the community. So he had to sell the remaining. He built about a third of the lots. He had to sell the remaining two-thirds and sold it to the Levitt Company to get the money that he needed. So that meant he was out of the picture then. And he turned over the control of the community to a civic association. And one of the first things they did was to get rid of the gate.
Very interesting. What? Tell me what else you know about the 50th anniversary celebration.
Saturday night, there is a... It's kind of the culminating event of the whole 50th anniversary year at the Country Club. And it's a kind of a homecoming fest. It's on a German theme, food, German food and drink. I'll be there, and lots of other people will be too. And I think from my observation, and I've observed most of it from Denver and on the internet and all that, it seems like it's been a real opportunity for Crofton to kind of reflect on what Crofton is. And I think that's really great, a great thing to happen. It's easy to just keep on going and not think too much about where you are and what it is, but I think people have really stopped to reflect about who they are and what they are.
And how would you describe what Crofton is?
It's... you know, in one sense, it's a suburban community, of course. But in another sense, it is, I would put the emphasis on the word community because of the nature of the way it was designed. You're just almost automatically drawn in to your neighbors, to the churches that are there and the schools that are there and the athletic groups that are there. But there's a strong sense of community there that I haven't seen when I've lived in other suburbs, even though people come and go just like any place else, you get jobs, you get change jobs. There apparently are other people like me who go back there often to visit their friends and feel like they miss it and say, oh, I wish I could be here instead of where I am. So it's that kind of community.
I really appreciate you talking to us about it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Joseph Brown is the author of From Sotweed to Suburbia, A History of Crofton, Maryland Area, 1660s to 1960s. On Saturday afternoon, he's speaking at the Linthicum Walks Farmhouse. It's part of Crofton's 50th anniversary celebration. We have more information about his lecture and other anniversary events on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. More of this conversation, too, including how Brown describes what has and what hasn't changed about Crofton. I'm Sheila Cast, ahead on Maryland Morning. Do Tom Hall and J. Wynn Russick love I Love Lucy on stage? To find out, stay with us on 88.1.
Producer Jamila Kay. Go to our website to learn more about a segment you just heard, check out our audio archives, or to join in the conversation yourself. You can also make a pledge to support local programming like Maryland Morning. That's wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
On 81, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Of course, everyone of a certain age will recognize that music. It's the theme song from I Love Lucy. It's from the title of the show At the Hippodrome, the classic TV series being presented on stage. I Love Lucy on stage. It's at the Hippodrome Theater in Baltimore. And to tell us about it, our theater critic J. Wynn Russick is here. Hey, Judy, how you doing?
Fine, Tom.
All right, so we've got this classic TV series, and they put it into a stage show, a musical. How's it work?
Well, it is a very odd hybrid, Tom. It's part TV and it's part theater. It was created by a writer-director named Rick Sparks, and he used sets that had been built for a 2001 50th anniversary touring I Love Lucy exhibit. Frankly, I think this production is better suited to accompanying an exhibit or perhaps being staged someplace like the Paley Museum in New York or in Los Angeles. But anyway, Sparks and a co-writer, a co-adapter named Kim Flagg, have selected two episodes from the TV series, and they have remounted them with live actors on stage and with a recreation of Ricky Ricardo's orchestra.
Of course, it started, I guess, in 1954, ran for, what, six
51,
or seven?
51, actually.
51,
okay. 51,
and
yeah.
ran for six or seven seasons. And, of course, it's still in reruns. I see it every morning at the gym, as a matter of fact. There are some pretty famous I Love Lucy episodes, sort of iconic. I mean, are any of those iconic episodes on stage? For example, I remember there's that episode where Lucy tries to do a commercial for Vita Mega Vitamin or whatever it was called. Right, and then, of course, there's the famous Lucy and Ethel in the Chocolate Factory. Did they take those for the stage?
No, they didn't. I have very fond memories of those episodes, too. They are the quintessential I Love Lucy episodes. But Sparks and Flagg chose less familiar episodes. The first episode comes from the first season, 51-52. It's an episode called The Benefit. And it's about Ricky performing at a benefit for Ethel's women's club, and Lucy is determined to perform with him. And the other episode is from the third season. It's called Lucy Has Her Eyes Examined. And this is also about Lucy's determination to be a performer. In this case, she auditions to do a jitterbug number in a Broadway show, but an eye doctor has put drops in her eyes that afternoon, and she can't see where she's going. So both episodes involve singing and dancing, and that makes sense on stage, I think.
So I talked to the young lady who plays Lucy in this in our series in the Bromo, and I just wonder, is there any kind of framing device for this production? I guess the audience in the theater becomes the audience for the TV show. How does this set up?
Right, right. We are supposed to be the studio audience for filming these episodes, and there's a host who explains things and welcomes things. He welcomes us. He is played by a man named Mark Christopher Tracy, and he's very congenial, a corny, joke-cracking guy. And there are also commercials. They're performed by a group they call the Crystal Tone Singers, and they do Alka-Seltzer. Remember Speedy Alka-Seltzer, the tap-dancing Alka-Seltzer tablet, and Brill Cream, a little dabble, do you, and Chevrolet, see the USA in your Chevrolet. There's even one very disturbing commercial for cold cream, and it's tested by putting some kind of radioactive material on a woman's face, and then they hold Geiger counters to show how well the cold cream takes this stuff off. I have to say, this was so disturbing, I looked it up when I got home, and it was a real ad campaign.
Oh, it's true. I remember reading about this.
Oh, brother.
Yeah.
The product had a slightly different name, but wow.
Oh, scary stuff. Now, I remember last season, I guess it was, Center Stage had a show in which the actors were impersonating the Marx Brothers. So are the actors here doing impersonations of Lucy and Ricky and Fred and Ethel? And you know, how do they do? Do they live up to those challenges?
Well, yes, they really are doing impersonations of those characters. I have to say, it's a fully professional cast, and the performances are the best thing about the show. There's a Cuban-American actor named Yuremus Losado, who is excellent as Ricky Ricardo. He brings a real spark to Ricky's best love lines, which I bet you can guess. Honey, I'm home, and Lucy, you got some splaining to do. And he's also very suave. He's really terrific. Kevin Remington and Laurie Hamill play the Ricardos' neighbors, Fred and Ethel Mertz. And they have a very cozy camaraderie between them. You feel that this is a happily married couple, just the way you felt that when you watched Vivian Vance and William Frawley, although I understand offstage they actually didn't get along really well. I have to say, I have some reservations about Thea Brooks, who plays Lucy. She wears a red wig, of course, and she does that big googly-eyed thing that Lucy did, and she gets that tantrum kind of wah sound. She has that right, and she's not a bad physical comedian. And she has the right vocal inflections, but her voice has almost a southern lilt to it. And on opening night, she also sounded a little bit like she had a cold. I'm not sure anybody can outdo or even match Lucille Ball as Lucy. And, Tom, for me, this raises a bigger question, and that is, do we really go to the theater to see actors impersonate TV characters? I mean, I Love Lucy, live on stage, is playing a 2-week run as part of the subscription series at the Hippodrome. I think at best this should be an add-on or maybe a weekend engagement. There are Tony Award-winning musicals and musical revivals in the Hippodrome season, and I Love Lucy on stage from its conception just isn't in the same league.
Yeah, so it sounds like you really didn't love I Love Lucy on stage, but you know, there are certainly lots of people who loved the TV program. So is this show is something that you think might appeal to certain folks?
It might. It might. I have to say that the theater was not full on opening night. And also, the show, the performance I went to, didn't get a standing ovation. And I can't remember the last time I went to a show at the Hippodrome that didn't get a standing ovation. There's no intermission between the episodes, although that would seem a logical place for a break. And I couldn't help wondering if they didn't do that because they were actually afraid people might not come back. This might be really cute and fun, maybe on a cruise ship or accompanying an exhibit. But as part of a series that supposedly brings Broadway to Baltimore, Tom, I have to say, explain that, Hippodrome.
All right, if you want to check it out, it's called I Love Lucy on Stage. It's at the Hippodrome through Sunday, the 26th of October. J. Ron Russick, thanks so much.
Thank you, Tom.
On 88.1, I'm Tom Hall. We've got complete information on our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning. Stay with us.
I love Lucy and she loves me. We're as happy as two can be. Sometimes we quarrel, but then how we love making up again. Lucy kisses like no one can. She's my missus and I'm her man. And life is heaven, you'll see. 'Cause I love Lucy, yes, I love Lucy, and Lucy loves me.
The McCormick Spice Company turned 125 years old last month. Our resident foodie, Sasha Wollhandler, joins me with a few thoughts on how to make the best use of their most famous product, Old Bay Seasoning. Sasha and her husband, Steve Susser, run Sasha's 527 restaurant and catering on Charles Street in Baltimore. Hey, Sasha, how you doing?
How are you, Tom?
Doing great. So the story of Old Bay is kind of fun. It's kind of interesting.
It's really amazing. You know, we started talking about McCormick and the incredible amount of spices that they've brought to America, brought and introduced us to and opened up things. It makes you think of all the immigrants that came to America. And Old Bay came with a gentleman named Gustav Brunn, who was fleeing from the Nazis, and he came to Baltimore in 1939.
Yeah.
And I guess he brought his spice grinder with him,
yeah,
because that's where Old Bay started from. Believe it or not, he wanted to open a spice company, and in fact, he did. And he put together Old Bay. There's like about 18 different components.
Yeah, there's all sorts of stuff in Old Bay seasoning.
Yeah. Celery salt, mustard, dry mustard, I guess, red pepper, black pepper, bay laurel leaves, cloves, allspice, pimento, ginger, mace, cardamom, cumin, paprika. The lore has that it was named, he used to call it the name of his spice company, which was Old Spice Company or something like that. It didn't really sell, so the lore has come that there was an old steamship that ran the Chesapeake from Virginia to Maryland, and it was called the Old Bay. So he named his spice after that.
There you go.
And of
I'm
course,
glad he didn't name it the Old Spice Company, because that ended up being a deodorant. That's a whole other thing.
That's a whole other thing. And I got to say that apparently crabs were hugely plentiful then, and all the bars served them, and he must have marketed his spice to them because it increased the beer drinking. So
right,
that's how the crabs in the Old Bay started. And
yeah, of course, the first thing folks think about with Old Bay is crabs and seafood in general. So crab cakes. I mean, when you make a crab cake, what happens? How do you use the Old Bay?
Well, of course, if you've never made crab cakes, folks, they're really, believe it, easy. And the recipe on the side of the Old Bay tin is pretty great. People, of course, there's as many crab cake recipes as there are people in the state of Maryland.
Right.
But basically, you take your crab meat after you've cleaned it. You put a little egg for binding. I like to put some really finely chopped scallion. I love, of course, lemon juice and lemon rind in mine. Dijon mustard, some breadcrumbs, a little Worcestershire, Old Bay, the Old Bay, of course, and onion powder and garlic powder. Put it all together. Don't move the crab meat around too much. And form your little patties. Saute them on both sides. Or you can broil them. And you have, of course, one of Maryland's delectable,
right,
wonderful things.
Right. And every restaurant in town says they have the best crab cake. And every person says she makes the best crab cake.
That's
so,
exactly,
you know,
right.
You can,
taste
fact,
your own and you'll decide you've got the best
that's
crab
cake. That's right. But as, and the thing on the recipe on the side of the can is a good place to
it
start.
It is a pretty good place to start.
How about hot crab dip?
Hot crab dip is, again, if you're having folks over for some drinks, there is nothing more Maryland than serving hot crab dip. Get some cream cheese, some sour cream, some mayonnaise, Old Bay, sherry, garlic powder, Worcestershire sauce, and bake it all together till it's hot and bubbly. Put your crab meat in, throw it in the oven. One, two, three. It's as quickly as I just told Tom. Bring it out. Have some toasted French bread cubes, some carrot sticks, some, you know, cucumbers. It would be, it's delicious, yeah, and it's as easy as that to do.
Yeah, it really is easy, and it's delicious. Everybody loves it. And also, you put crab on bruschetta, too.
I think you can make delicious crab bruschetta. Take crab meat, put it, you're going to make a crab salad, folks. You're just going to pick the crab meat clean. Again, take that mayonnaise, put your Old Bay into it, put a good squeeze of lemon or lime juice, I like. Again, you can add a little sherry. You're making a crab salad here, so it's whatever your taste likes. Mound that on some grilled French bread and put a little dicing of scallion on top. That is a spectacular hors d'oeuvre, again, with some beer or some fabulous ice-cold sparkling champagne. What could be better, except for my crab puffs?
Yes, that's right. I had crab puffs at your house a couple times. They are delish. So how
Take
do you do them?
Mayonnaise, crab, a little egg for that binding again. I like some mozzarella cheese. Of course, I put Old Bay in it, a tiny bit of salt and pepper, and a touch of cayenne. Mound it again, folks, on top of that little shard of French bread that you have. Pop them in the oven for, I guess, a few minutes and till it's bubbly. And what a hot, wonderful hors d'oeuvre that is.
Yeah, simple and terrific. You can have thousands of them. You also make a terrific crab mac and cheese.
Well, I learned this from Lindsay, who is one of our catering assistants at Sasha's. She made a great crab mac and cheese. I brought you some crab chips right there.
That's right. Here's the crab chips.
And,
here. And you put the crab chips on top. These
on
are the
top.
Utz potato chips that are made with crab stuff.
Crab seasoning on top of them. They've got the Old Bay chips. They are delicious.
It's like Homer Simpson.
And when you're making your mac and cheese and you're making your Mornay sauce to go in instead of the nutmeg, you know, you've got your roux going and your cup of milk and you're putting the cheese in to make your Mornay sauce. And we'll put this recipe up there for you folks. Put on a good dousing of the Old Bay mixture. Mix that all together. Put your crab in with your mac and cheese. Then you're going to take panko breadcrumbs, which you know I've spoken about here before, those great Japanese crunchy, crunchy breadcrumbs, and crush these great potato chips in it. It's really spicy. Add a little bit more Old Bay and put that on top. I am telling you, it is magnificent. Crab mac and cheese with little crab potato chips on top.
Great stuff. Great
How
stuff.
How good is that, Tom?
Indeed. Sasha Wohlhandler and her husband, Steve Slisser, own Sasha's 527 Restaurant and Catering on Charles Street in Baltimore. Come to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, for more information. That's all we got time for. Thanks, Sasha.
Spice up your life. Keep it hot, sweet, and smoky with a little Old Bay and some champagne and beer.
Hot, sweet, and smoky, indeed. That'll do it for us today. Coming up Friday, Lieutenant Governor Anthony Brown joins Sheila for a conversation before the November 4th election. I hope you can join us then. And finally, thanks to everybody who made a pledge during our fall membership campaign. All of us at Maryland Morning and at WYPR appreciate your interest in our work, your support of our mission, and your commitment to the idea and the ideals of public radio. Thank you for all you do to make this show and everything you hear on WYPR possible. On 88.1 WYPR, it's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall. Have a great day.